I'm guessing that over the past nearly 7 years, you've observed in me a certain ambivalence about power and authority. It took me quite a while, 3 or 5 years, to even be comfortable introducing myself as Rabbi or Rabbi Ferency, or my current favorite is Reb Alon that Jeff cited. I like that a lot. And I don't think I've ever pulled the card, I'm the rabbi and I said so. But I think I'm writing one for myself. So I'll have it, like maybe I'll use it once a year on special occasions. It's hard. I came from a lineage of teachers who were, certainly my last mentor was very non-authoritarian. And that has its own faults and problems. So I want to think, given this week's Torah portion, the parasha, what is power and leadership? They're words we don't define very carefully. They're words like arrogance, like some other words that have a slippery meaning that might mean different things to different people. So I want to start by thinking about what bad leadership is. And our prime example of that is the pharaoh. The pharaoh, really just the king of Egypt. That was a local word. He's also in other places referred to as Egypt's king. No different, just a title. By some analyses, maybe even the name given to him. And he is, says the book of Exodus, the new king, to which our sages are surprised. How did a pharaoh arise who did not know Joseph, who wasn't aware of the good deeds of our ancestors and our sages? Question, maybe it was the same pharaoh, but he closed his eyes to the past. Elsewhere in Midrashim, in our sages' understanding of Torah and Hebrew scripture, we're offered the idea that there were a few persons who claimed divinity for themselves and thereby brought about their own ruin. And the first to appear in Torah is Pharaoh. That there's something intrinsically wrong with his character and with his approach to power that the Greeks would have called hubris, a sense of overweening pride and arrogance before God, and a sense that his power was divinely ordained, maybe even like Napoleon pulled the crown upon himself, that's something he claimed for himself. So with that piece in mind, I want to address in this question of leadership and power one of the more difficult aspects of the early verses and chapters of Exodus, the questions of free will that are raised when we hear that God hardens or strengthens Pharaoh's heart such that Pharaoh will not let the people go, and God can illustrate and demonstrate God's ultimate justice through signs and portents, redeeming the people from Pharaoh, because if Pharaoh would have acquiesced, it would have made God look less stern and supreme. So one of the interesting things that our sages point out about v'kibed et lev paro v'chazek lev paro, that God made Pharaoh's heart strong or heavy, says Rashbam, one of Rashi's descendants writing in about the 12th century, says that this is not an adjective, that this is not a state, it's an intransitive verb. That Pharaoh, maybe through his youth and maturity, became a person of strong and obdurate heart. That Pharaoh lost the flexibility and the pliancy that a good leader might have, that stopped seeing alternatives, stopped seeing the dangers of his own works, stopped seeing different ways to reflect upon the reality of leadership and power, and that maybe power isn't ultimate, or at least that ultimate power corrupts absolutely. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. So we have this other situation, trying to understand what Pharaoh's problem, what the leader's problem was. And to do this, I'm going to jump ahead about 6 months to the story of Bilam and Balak. And one of the things we learn about the king Balak is that after he had seen all the wonders and miracles and joys of the people Israel, he remained unchanged. He didn't acquiesce to God's sovereignty. He didn't see God's power. He didn't change his religion. He didn't change his faith one iota. And that's a symbol, say our sages, of something that Pharaoh did. So again and again in the early plagues, Pharaoh has his necromancers, his court magicians, his court illusionists repeat the tricks that Moses does. As if to say, you know, it's a little big deal in Hebrew. It's not a big deal what you can do. I can do it too. Anyone can do that. But what our sages note is that he didn't see that there was a difference. He didn't see that there was a qualitative difference. He ignored the evidence of his eyes. He proceeded to lie to himself. He proceeded to find the information and the news and validate his own circumstances, his own opinions. And he said, you know, he didn't see that what the sorcerers did was not the same thing that Moses and Aaron were doing. They were doing parlor tricks. Moses and Aaron, at least to the scriptures' understanding, were doing miracles, were demonstrating God's will. We're doing something distinct and defined and irrefutable. So, say our sages, the Pharaoh just claimed, you know, that's just a different kind of sorcery. You're not doing anything different. That's just maybe better sorcery or different. It operates differently. My magicians do it through necromancy. You do it through reading the bones. It's all sorcery. It's all parlor tricks. When clearly to our story, to our parasha, what Moses and Aaron do is quantitatively and certainly qualitatively different. That's bad leadership. That's problematic leadership, that kind of hubris that makes one intransigent and obdurate in the face of new information, incapable of seeking advisors who might disagree with one, with the leader, trying to formulate new and nuanced opinions, just living in a binary state, in a place of thick-wittedness. So what is power and leadership, and how do we advocate in a healthy and productive way? What does it mean to have followers? I mean, that's usually the business school definition of a leader, is someone with followers. But what does it mean to really influence one's followers? What does it mean to wield power in a way that is safe and healthy and productive and fruitful for the community at large, for one's followers? I don't think it means inculcating obedience. And here, you know, we talk about Moses being Rabbeinu, our greatest teacher, our leader par excellence, but I'm going to take issue with him just a little, and I'm going to cite Maimonides. Now, unfortunately, I can't cite Maimonides. I only took 2 years of college Arabic, so I can't tell you what he said in the original Arabic, which would, in this case, be helpful, but no less, I'm going to use a translation. So in this parasha, it says that the people hearkened, they shama, they heard, they listened to Moses. And Maimonides says that this verb often indicates to obey. That's the part where I really would like to see the original so I could tell you if I understood that to be obedience or something a little more subtle. Obedience is good when you're three. I don't think obedience is a real form of leadership anyway. That's a form of coercion. And one of my great ambivalence about I'm the rabbi, that's I said so, or I'm the dad, or I'm the mom, I said so, it doesn't inculcate real value into a child or a congregant or a coworker. It doesn't help them to grow in independence and in full self, as a full self. It just makes them follow what you do. That's called heteronomous morality rather than autonomous morality, finding a morality externally rather than growing inside oneself a sense of right and wrong. That's doing what's right because you're afraid of what people might say, not doing what's right because you have an internal compass and integrity. So, you know, by way of Maimonides, I take issue with Maimonides' understanding of Moses' leadership, and I don't think that was the epitome, the best case of Moses' leadership. But there are other things that Moses does that coax the people forward, that, to use Rabbi Brad Artson's sense of how God interacts with us, that is a lure, that draws us like a glimmering emblem forward, that attracts us. A leadership by attraction, let's call it. So the people didn't hear God, we're told. They had kotzer ruach, their ruach, their spirit was mekatzer, shortened, contracted, narrowed. They couldn't, ruach is also kind of a breath. So what it intends to tell us is that they were avut de souffle. They were out of breath. They were breathless. They couldn't breathe for themselves. And what Moses did is to give them hope. You know, our sages say both that they couldn't, from their present state of oppression and suppression, their heart couldn't assimilate God's salvation, that God was coming. And says the Bechor Shor, another sage, they didn't feel it. They still couldn't feel it inside. So I think Moses, in his continual approach to the people, in his continual speeches, even though he was arel svataim, short of tongue, circumcised in the mouth, he tried to draw them in with words of hope and convey that there was a way out, a way forward. That, I think, is some kind of leadership, because leadership isn't about drawing the biggest crowd. It's not a popularity contest. It's not about having a standing ovation. It's about pulling people forward by force of vision, giving them a goal, giving them a shared purpose that is noble and uplifting. And sometimes you do that in big ways, in front of an auditorium full of people, and oftentimes you do it in very small, subtle, and interpersonal ways. At least that's my experience as a rabbi, but for those of you who are counselors and teachers, yes, there are times you get to do it in front of a classroom, but some of the most profound moments we have with professors and physicians is the one-on-one, where they change our lives and move us, help us tack to a better place. So among the first plagues that the magicians can't duplicate is the lice. And at that point, the magicians say, you know, maybe God does exist, and maybe this is something beyond us. Maybe this is no longer a parlor trick. Now, I'm not advocating for the historical veracity of the text, but within the story itself, within the Torah itself, there is a moment when the sorcerers of Egypt give up. They despair of their abilities to follow God's actions and to replicate and to ape the works of Moses. And they point to God. They say, God's finger must be in here in a way that our parlor tricks can't contain. Why the lice? I mean, I have kids. It's pretty easy to make lice. You just exchange hats. You've got lice all over the place. So Rashi points out this interesting midrash. A demon has no power over an object smaller than a barley grain. Which is just an interesting midrash. You know, I've talked to you a little bit about how our tradition views angels, and apparently that's how, one of the rules of demons, is that they can only affect big things. They can't affect the microscopic. They can only affect the macroscopic. I don't know why. I haven't done further research. Maybe for a high holiday sermon I will. But that's interesting, that on a one-on-one basis, in the small, in the particular, in the interpersonal, you have a much greater chance of doing good. Demons work in giant auditoriums. Demons preach to the masses and lift them up and make Leni Riefenstahl movies. But the good work one-on-one, maybe. That's a very powerful, and maybe the most powerful and good leadership is the intimate leadership that draws people together and uplifts them and mobilizes communities. As I've mentioned, we're starting or hoping to work the next few months with Justice Knox, a community organizing group. We're hoping to bring them into the community to help us think about our future and what we can do in our community. But I think what Rashi and others are pointing to is that God's finger is small. Like E.E. Cummings would say, nobody, not even the rain, has, help me out with the ending, has hands so small. Anyway. Close, I'm close. And I want to finish with another poem by Yehuda Halevi, writing about 8 centuries ago in Spain. This, I think, if I recall correctly, was translated by my friend and rabbi, Ami Adler. I'll read it to you and then hand out the rest. Just hold on to these until I finish reading it. Creator of all, you are in all that is small. To the far you are near, to the near you are here. An ark was your home, so is heaven's dome. Its hosts sing your praises, and you are host to their clan. The spheres cannot hold you, but a room can. That's real leadership. Start small, start intimate, start subtle, be nuanced.